It's a brand new best podcast in baseball, and this episode we have a glove story. Historian and author Ed Wheatley joins me to discuss his book, Finest in the Field. It's a history of baseball told, of course, through the gloves. We're going to talk Rawlings gloves. We're going to talk the history of the glove. We're going to talk favorite gloves. And, of course, in the end, every glove story is a love story. Stay tuned. Cue the music. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the best podcast in baseball, brought to you by Closets by Design of St. Louis. I'm St. Louis Post-Dispatch baseball writer Derek Gould, joined this week by a friend, author, historian, someone who I've known a long time, who we have told lots of stories about baseball together in our conversations. And I'm really looking forward to this because I get to talk to Ed Wheatley about his new book just in time for Father's Day. It is, of course, The Finest in the Field, A History of Baseball. Great to talk with you. I'm so glad we're able to work this out.
Yeah, I appreciate being here. I appreciate telling the story and rekindling memories and the love of your baseball glove. And, you know, like you said, it's ironic that this thing, you spell glove with the word love in it. And, you know, it's probably the most personal thing in baseball. And for a Father's Day and a father's memory, is there anything better than their memories of a catch with their child? And all those catch memories all come back to the glove.
All right, so let's start where it began for you. Tell me about your first glove. I know you like asking this question of others, so I'm going to flip it on you. What was your first glove?
Yeah, it's funny. You ask anybody, they'll tell you, you know, like I said, 40 years later, they don't tell you about the blue-eyed, pigtailed, freckle-faced girl from grade school, but they can recite without pausing, you know, with the make, the model, color, whose signature was in it, and how they formed the pocket. And for me, mine was a Mickey Mantle glove. Mickey Mantle was, you know, the big name in baseball. When I was growing up, my dad was with the Yankees organization. And so I had a lot of exposure to him. And so it was the Mickey Mantle glove. And, you know, we would put Glovolium on him, put the ball in there, tie it in string, you know, and then get it out, pound it for a while. But it was, to me, the Mickey Mantle. And throughout, I used a style like that. And now, you know, because I still play baseball in senior leagues all across the country. And I use a Nolan Arenado model glove.
Oh, really? Do you, what position do you play? Third with it?
I play third, and I play shortstop.
That's very good. Yeah, that's a nice glove. The Arenado glove is very
yes.
Nice. What do you like about it?
Well, you know, it just felt right. You know, you go through. I think that's the thing for a lot of people in their stories, because the glove is so personal. It, you know, spikes come and go as you change. Bats break. But your glove stays with you if you take care of it, you know, forever. And you mold it. It kind of molds to your finger, to your hand. And when you look at gloves and you start trying on, this is the one that felt the best. Plus, it's, you know, it's not big like an outfield glove. So it sinks into the position and your hand fits as you get it. But it's really the feel. You know, I remember Bob Costas telling me when he got his first glove, and I was asking him, how'd you get yours? Well, we were at a Western Auto store. If you remember, Western Auto used to sell gloves. And he went down and down. His dad was standing there, and he picked this one feels good. And he says, who's in it? It was Harvey Keen. Maybe today's fans don't really know Harvey Keen, but he's a great ball player of the 50s and 60s, and even managed the Brewers against the Cardinals in the two World Series. But, you know, so much of it is what position you play, and then you find the one that feels the best. And, you know, maybe there's hopefully some little gold dust from an Arenado model left in the glove, you know?
I like the stories that flip that, where the glove they pick out is actually the position that they start to play. And they love, you know, like you hear some stories of kids picking out first base glove just because it looked cooler or catcher's mitt. And it's like, all right, well, it also goes with all this other equipment. My first glove was a Fernando Valenzuela, but right-handed Rawlings model. That was the first glove that I got. The first glove I got to pick out was a Dave Winfield Rawlings, and it was black and gorgeous. And I love that glove. But the glove that I was brought up to revere was my father's A2000. Okay. He saved money to buy because it was the best glove on the market at the time, he felt. And so he had his paper route and all his chores and everything like that. And he had it still when we would play catch. And it was not a glove that I got to use very often. He loved it so much. It was a great, amazing glove. But when my son played high school baseball at Metro here in St. Louis, my dad gave him the A2000.
Oh, wow.
And my dad, or my son, he had a glove, an infield glove. He played a lot of infield. But when he played the outfield, he played it with my dad's A2000. How about that?
That's great. I mean, you know, a couple points to that is, like, you know, people really don't share your gloves. I mean, that's kind of a rule. You don't put your hand in another guy's glove.
Yeah.
But you know, the Fernando glove that you speak of, Fernando Valenzuela, that is covered in the book because it had a kind of unique, unique story. And I wanted to add that Fernando Mania episode is one of those baseball moments that took place there in the 80s. Cause we go all the way back to the 1880s, all the way up to current player Cal Raleigh and stuff. So, I mean, there's always those unique little nuggets of, the stories that we try to entwine in this book from the evolution of baseball and the evolution of the glove, because people may not know first 10 years, they really didn't have gloves in baseball and how the glove evolved.
Yeah, they were like sponges for the catchers, and fielders were able to catch the ball off a hop for an out so that they weren't using their gloves so they were using their hands. But it was a whole different type of game. Now we see this game of power and velocity. Back then it was kind of more a game of placement and strategy. Strategy, but not as much power.
And when the glove came about, you know, scores were like 32-21. Mm-hmm. It added a defensive perspective, made it, you know, 5-4, 7-6 type games. Rules came in because the first glove the fingers weren't even covered. The ones that, you know, came out in the 1880s. And as a glove changed, rules changed, and it molded the game to what we have today.
Yeah, I can't imagine that there'd be too many catchers eager to catch Jacob Mizorowski if not for a catcher's mitt. If the evolution of the catcher's mitt wasn't such that that it is to bring us to the modern day, I'm not sure that they would have valued 103 like folks do.
Well, even in those days, those first days, the pitchers actually were required to throw underhanded, kind of like you were throwing horseshoes with a straight arm. You weren't allowed to overhand. And once the catchers got those pillow type gloves that, you know, just kind of crushed in there, they allowed pitchers to throw overhand because then it came a harder pitch and then moving. And the catcher, as you said, in those days, how far would he have to play today catching him? Because, you know, they actually stood about 15 feet behind the plate and would take it on a bounce
until
the gloves came. So, I mean, that's the beauty of baseball, and the beauty of all these stories is going back and how all this evolved. And, like, you know, you talk about getting your first glove. Johnny Bench, everybody thinks, well, he got a catcher's glove. No, he didn't. He got a fielder's glove, got it after he spent the whole summer picking cotton. He earned the money to do it, and he changed over. But – you know, those pillow gloves that we just spoke of.
Yeah.
He changed the glove, him and Randy Hundley, but it was Bench that really made it famous by putting that hinge. So a catcher's glove kind of became just like a first baseman's, where you can snap the ball and he could keep his hand protected behind his back and quit breaking fingers. So,
and that led to framing in a lot of ways because of the way the glove worked. You could do more framing with that.
Yeah, you're just not doing this, you know.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, the history of the glove is the history of the game. The two are intertwined. And so, too, is the history of St. Louis, the history of the baseball glove. Can you describe the key role and the connection to the history of the glove that St. Louis has, starting from the very beginning with the Bill Doak model?
Well, I'll back up a little
bit. Or even before then, really. Before
that, and we'll talk about the Rawlings brothers. Had a like a general goods store, and, you know, they sold everything in for sporting goods. Baseball was coming in to play, you know, bats, balls, but they sold fishing equipment, boxing gloves, skating. And we've got one whole chapter on the evolution of Rawlings. And you can see these catalogs from the early 1880s, just everything they sold. And as baseball became popular, that's where they began their focus. But they, you know, up until just the past decade, you know, they were into basketball, football, everything. But they then became, instead of a reseller from, you know, all the places come to their store and then they sell, they became a producer of these baseball gloves. And so that we have in there, you know, the first patent, you know, with the fingerless covered gloves. And so they actually, for people wanting to know, well, were they in Rawlings, downtown St. Louis? They were in several locations, but the one they actually started in was on the corner there of 8th and Chestnut, right where you see the big bell tower downtown. And then they moved up to around 21st and Jefferson, about a mile away down in downtown St. Louis. And that's where the gloves were produced. And then they had facilities out in Washington, Missouri, and other areas outstate Missouri. And that's how the glove came to being. But the first glove, as we've spoke several times here, was just, it framed the palm of the hand, and it was really not for catching, but for protection. If, you know, a first baseman or catchers taking that hard throw in it. If you talk about catchers, if you go back and look at some of the first pictures or playing cards, you'll see catchers with gloves on both hands, you know, fingers exposed, but both had the palms. And then eventually around 1900, they covered the fingers. And so they were just like big, thick winter gloves. Mm-hmm. And then a St. Louis Cardinal, Bill Doak, a pitcher for the Cardinals, came up with the idea, let's connect the first finger to the thumb with a strap of leather. And that became kind of the first pocket, but and it revolutionized the game. But the interesting thing that has always perplexed me, and I raised that question in the book, why didn't he just keep going and attaching all the fingers?
Yeah.
A lot of the play, because it really took until the late 30s, early 40s to have a glove that evolved with attachment of lace through all five fingers. And, you know, it's like players were superstitious. They didn't like it. They liked the flexibility, but, you know, they really didn't have the pocket because they were catching really a grasping of your fingers. And the evolution, I speak of how many people remember their dad, mom, coaches hollering at them, use two hands. Mm-hmm. You don't hear that as much today because the gloves are just so such a pocket. But in those days, catch it, hold it, because they didn't have pockets. And that used two hands, that's where it really evolved.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's kind of taking away the notion of soft hands, I guess, right? But, I mean, it still matters. But, like, the notion of soft hands was kind of, could you coil in with the glove, which the glove now does naturally because of what you're describing.
Right. And it, you know, and it's interesting you talk about that softness. You know, we talk about Johnny Bench and Mimmin, how he picked cotton. You know, I went to with Rawlings the Gold Glove Hall of Famers, asking them questions about their first glove and what they like, and you know, what did they use, so that, you know, I want the reader to all of a sudden, I did it like Johnny Bench, I did it like Ozzie Smith, you know, you know, and how I wrapped it and tied it up, and did I use shaving cream, Glovolium, Vaseline, lanolin? You know, Ozzie Smith always said lanolin made it the softest, and that's how he wanted to feel. But, you know, a backstory is a guy like Ozzie Smith, what was your first glove, Oz? It was a paper bag that he formed into a glove, and he would go play catch against the stoop and catch him with this paper glove made in. That he made until he found, you know, living up in that area of social economics. He found a glove left out at a park by the rec center there in Watts, been sitting in the rain, and he took it home, worked it all back, and that was his first glove. So,
wow,
all these little stories of how the greats became great.
Yeah, it's great. When the St. Louis also has maybe an underrated role in kind of what we're talking about, like advancements of the gloves and everything. And it comes from the greatest of them all, and Stan Musial. He was the first to use a style of glove right that became much popular later on. Is that a good way to kind of describe it, Ed?
Well, I'd back up and say, you know, Musial actually had two gloves. that he really focused on, because he is the first major leaguer to play 1,000 games in the infield and 1,000 games in the outfield.
Okay.
And I think what you're referencing, he had his first baseman admit, because we, one of the things your viewers, when they see this book and the beautiful photography, is we have all these different gloves of these players in their moments. And we may talk about some of the moments in the gloves, but you'll see Musial's, both his first baseman's mitt and his fielding glove. And then he became the leading spokesman that will ring a bell for so many people of our ages, the trapeze, which I think is what you're,
yeah,
some people may call it the six finger glove. It was a trapeze. And it was one that really took America. It was a new evolution in the late 50s and across the early 60s. That's what everybody wanted, you know.
What was the idea behind it? What was better about it or more popular about it? Because I do remember it also cycling back for a stretch.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of college outfielders were using it, I think, in the 90s. And stuff.
And there's still people using, you know, Ozzie Smith used it his entire career.
Wow.
That's what he used. And, you know, you didn't necessarily think, would he have something a little more special, you know, for shortstop? But no, he used the trapeze. It was just that flexibility. And, you know, it didn't have a pocket in there where, you know, sometimes a lot of players wanted that H where they had openings in there so you could see through it. Mm-hmm. At times, like in the sun and that. But inside the pocket, it looked like a sixth finger. That's why it gets that nickname. But it was the leather in between the first finger and the thumb and goes across and lace. And it had some flexibility in there. There was no finger in it, mm-hmm. but it was just the way it curved and had some extra feeling ability. Some of it is just what gives you confidence when catching balls. And, you know, some of that comes back to, as we spoke, what glove is most comfortable. You know, you will go in the book and see the actual ads. You know, Stan Musial is the promoter of the trapeze. And all these gloves of lineage going all the way back to the 1880s, we tried to spotlight, you know, the major league player who was the promoter of those gloves.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. One of my favorite stories in the book is actually the crusade that Joe DiMaggio went on.
Yeah.
And he had a catch in the World Series made against him.
Yeah.
And he had an issue with the glove, and there's a wonderful plot twist in your story mm-hmm. about this. Can you kind of set the stage for folks about what happened and then what DiMaggio did and what you found?
Yeah. You know, Joe was this, you know, great, great, great player, highly respected. Mm-hmm. It was a 1947 World Series and it was in game 6. Al Gianfrido, a very small defensive replacement for the Brooklyn Dodgers, was brought in. And this could have meant if the Yankees win, they win the World Championship here in Game 6. If not, they play for Game 7. Well, Gianfrido used a red Rolf glove. It's a double RR down in the palm if people see it. You'll see the exact glove and all the whole pictures and everything. I mean, all these gloves, the Hall of Fame opened up pretty much. You know, we got the Willie Mays over the head catch from the 54 World Series. There's his glove. He made that catch. And there's a story that he borrowed that glove that day. But the red Rolf glove was very popular. It had kind of a webbing that went above the fingers to the thumb, and it was giving you that extra reach, was kind of how it was promoted, and it became very popular. Well, here we come in up to bat in the late innings of the game of game 6. DiMaggio comes to bat, runners on first and second. The Dodgers are actually winning. DiMaggio drives one to deep, deep, deep left field, left center, all in Yankee Stadium, which, you know, that was known as Death Valley. Mm-hmm. And right there at the bullpen gate, where it has big 405 numbers on the gate, little Al Gianfrido was a lefty. He reaches up and over and catches the ball in this web of this red Rolf glove. And, you know, DiMaggio hits it thinking, I've just won the World Series, you know, walk off World Series win, rounds first, and sees Gianfrido makes this catch. And he kicks the dirt. And, you know, newspapers and all sports press then immediately came out. he's human. He has emotion, because that was the way DiMaggio always carried himself. Well, he goes on and said that glove should never been allowed, and they would have never made that catch and I'd have hit the homer. And he went on a full campaign to Major League Baseball. And Major League Baseball bought into his story, even though many, many players are using the glove, and makes the glove illegal, can't be used anymore in baseball. And as I said, many, many, many players are using the glove. And in our research, guess what we found? Pictures of Joe DiMaggio using the Red Rove glove.
That's so great.
Little kind of stories, you know, favorite stories and things that make it so great.
One of the more striking photos, there are these great detailed studio photos of the gloves. They're just incredible, especially if you like baseball gloves, because they're presented basically like art in this book.
That's correct.
And one of the more striking ones for me that I saw was Bob Gibson's. Mm-hmm. And part of it is because it's clearly well used. It's worn. It's got a lot of stories to tell, I'm sure. But one that's very apparent is that there's a part of it that looks like it's a lottery ticket. Like it's been scratched off to see if he won. And the truth behind it is it had been, right? It had been scratched off.
That is correct. You know, players at times, especially in the past, would generate between, you know, when money wasn't as big contracts, you know, hey, can I get this money to use this glove from this vendor or whoever? But he did have a contract with a different glove maker that year, and Gibson did not like the glove. As the year went on, he liked his old glove, so he went back to his old glove, which was a Rawlings model glove. And on the Rawlings model, right, you know, there's always that round red with the R on it, and then the label on the wristband. You can see, as you said, like a lottery ticket. He scratched out that Rawlings R, and he painted over and kind of ripped up the Rawlings emblem on the wristband. So he was not violating his contract by having him shown using a different the Rawlings motto when he had a contract with someone else. So it's all little stories like that, or how things happen in the game. We spoke of Willie Mays' catch in the 54 World Series, Mickey Mantle's catch in the 56 World Series, where he runs deep into left center Death Valley trying to trace down a Gil Hodges hit. And Mantle makes that catch. Don Larson was the pitcher, pitches the only perfect game in World Series history.
Go.
And yeah. Don was a good friend of mine, and he said, if it would not have been for Mickey making that catch, you would not know Don Larson.
Oh, wow.
Because it set the stage for him to bank it. And that's how we do it with all these. And you'll see the actual glove, but we'll also build a story or the background of what's happening.
One of my favorite things that Rawlings does that people probably know widely, but it's been going on for a while, and it was always kind of this wonderful – touch that Rawlings did, was if a player won a gold glove, they put a gold patch on the glove. And the only players who could have a gold patch, they reserved the gold patches for those who had won a gold glove. Yadier Molina, when he used a Rawlings chest protector, had a gold patch on his chest because he'd won a gold glove. Something I did not know until this year, and I guess it makes sense, but I just had presumed that it was the case, is that the player gets a gold glove or gets a gold patch on all their gloves, which I thought was interesting because, you know, Ramon Urias won a gold glove with the Baltimore Orioles playing third base. And I saw him with an outfielder's glove or maybe a first baseman's glove. I'm trying to remember. And it had a gold patch on it. And I was like, well, wait a minute now.
Yeah.
You didn't – what? And, but you know, a gold glover is a gold glover. So they made him a glove for these other positions that he has to play. And, you know, he's got a gold patch on him. They also now do platinum patches.
Yes.
So like a guy like Nolan Arenado would have a platinum patch if he wishes on his glove. Are there other kind of traditions like that that go with gloves? There's certainly a lot of superstitions.
Very many superstitions,
that go with gloves, yeah.
And, you know, there are things, and you're right, and we've got pictures, and I, if you know, We have a big section in the book also about the Gold Glove winners by team and the numbers. St. Louis Cardinals crossed the 100th with Mason Wynn this year. Yeah. The next highest is in the 70s. I mean, so you can also pick up that history of baseball, why they were winning teams or teams built on defense and all their Gold Gloves. So
like the Baltimore Orioles with all Gold Glovers all over.
Oh, they did. Yeah, they're the next one, you know. Well, when you got Brooks Robinson grabbing 16, you know, I joke, I'm good friends still today with Clete Bowyer's daughter and son-in-law. And he finally got a Gold Glove when he went to Atlanta. You know, all those years he played in New York, he didn't ever win it because Brooks Robinson was there winning them. Same way, how many good shortstops in the National League were good, but there was Ozzy. And you know, we get into some of those stories. But, I mean, there are unique things about that have come on about, you know, the size of the glove. Because there's a history of this glove sizing changing all the time. Because, you know, players, was it back in the 80s and 90s, they kind of wanted those softball gloves that they can, you know, reach up into the stands and catch them or whatever. Goes back to part of that story with the Joe DiMaggio catch. But it that those are all the keys, and you know it is very humbling to have attended Gold Glove award ceremonies and see the competition for these gloves, because they announce like the three, and it's like, here's, you know, Academy Award, and the winner goes, and to see what it really means to these guys, that because they are the finest in the field, the best of the best, and then you know the. You know, we get stories like, you know, Cal Raleigh, the first time he saw the book, he's flipping through. I mean, there's all the greats. You know, we've even got the story from 100 years ago this year when Roger Hornsby, with his Bill Doak glove, tags Babe Ruth out in game seven with two outs in the bottom of the ninth and with his Bill Doak glove. But all these stories, as we've mentioned, great players. But, you know, here's a guy like Cal Raleigh looking through the book, keep going. And then all of a sudden a few expletive deletes pop out as, I'm in here. How am I in here? Well,
that's really good.
You not win a platinum glove, the best of the best in the American League. And it just paralleled all he was doing on offense last year. But I mean, the glove is just, it's so personal. It's molded by the player. He's invested all this time. It's his. And, you know, many of these guys, they use the same glove. Troy Tulowitzki is one. He used his same glove his entire career. You know, they can take them apart and rebuild them and all that. And, you know, Ozzie Smith, you know, how many gloves did you have over time? It's a single-digit number.
Wow.
He said. You become so invested in that piece of equipment. And we brought out, you know, the story of the evolution of the game, the ties, the evolution of glove, and how that impacted the evolution of the game. And then we went into these different moments of baseball memories that we think many of the readers will immediately recognize and go back in time. And all of a sudden, there's the glove, you know, the story about how that moment happened.
Nolan Arenado gives his glove to his dad. His dad has the collection of gloves. Mm-hmm. He had it. I don't know if he still does, but he had it presented and everything like that. So Arenado would win a Gold Glove and be working on the next year's glove. And the old glove would go to his dad. Rick Eckstein, the brother of David Eckstein, every year would have his brother's glove, and he would use it for 1 year so that it would be ready to be the gamer for David.
Loosen up, soften.
Yeah, and Paul Goldschmidt is somewhat the Johnny Appleseed of first baseman gloves, because I have seen three different first baseman gloves left behind either at a ballpark or for a former team with Goldschmidt stitched on it, and they said that Paul just left it behind because someone was going to have to learn. I don't know if it was like he was thinking, well, someone's going to have to learn first base, but he was like, someone can always use this. And sure enough, there's usually somebody who has to learn first base or doesn't have a first baseman's glove, or a coach who is going to go over during infield, and they have a Paul Goldschmidt model, which I find interesting.
Yeah, I know. I probably know why Arenado's dad has them all. Nolan said when he got his first glove, you know, black Derek Jeter glove.
Oh, yeah.
His dad and him went out and picked it up, came home. He goes, hey, I'm going to go out and play. He says, no, you're not. What do you mean? You're not going out of this house till your name and phone number is on your glove. He said about six times in the ensuing year or two, phone rings. I think I have Nolan Arenado's glove here.
That's pretty good. You know what? I should ask. I'll ask him the next time if he still writes his number in his glove.
Yeah, that is something, too, that we talk about things unique, how they would all write something, famous, like, a player, my third baseman, there's a couple of them that were like E5, was there. Breathe or something. But they have their little special messages on their gloves. But, the other thing is you were mentioning Paul leaving his or that. We get back to some of those old players like a Kirk Flood, or a Kenny Boyer. Mm-hmm. Both won a lot of gold gloves. So I talked to their families. And in those days, they just disappeared or gave them away. You don't have that heritage. So it was tough. A lot of looking, a lot of going to different teams, the Hall of Fame, to get the glove that we wanted for these beautiful photos. But it has always meant something. But I was then shocked that, you mean you don't have your dad's glove or anything?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I find it interesting how much a glove is cherished, and yet sometimes it's cherished for what it was and when it was in use, and then they move on. And that's kind of the case for everybody, right? Like there are gloves in my past that I loved at the time, but you move on from.
You're right. I mean, but there are those who. Since we started this book, when Rawlings first came and asked me to do it, and we started putting together, and people know what I was working on, they immediately, I got mine. And, the other thing, too, I will say that I also went to several key women softball players, some from the Hummers of the 70s, the fast pitch, cool. College females, to ask about their memories of their first glove, because they've built this professional and college career as well. They will tell you the same thing every boy and man tells you. And they two of them pulled out and brought me, here was my glove. And funny, it was they were both Stan Musial trapeze gloves.
Really?
But I mean, so it is a thing that's just not male focused or any of that. This is all about the love of the game, whether it's softball or baseball, but that personal item, they've got stored away, that glove.
A lot of the modern touches of the glove are, the details of it. Mm-hmm. You have Rawlings where you can design a glove now and you make it your own, whole lot of colors. Several of the players, a couple of the players have glove designs that they use during BP and everything like that. That basically the outer shell is like Batman comic book style pousing patterns. There's Francisco Lindor, who seems to have a new glove every week. That is
in every stylish uniform combination.
Yeah, that's right. In every uniform. There's also been changes in somewhat how players wear their gloves.
Oh yeah.
Outfielders looking for, everybody looking for that extra reach, like Joe DiMaggio didn't want, but folks to have to wear their glove higher up, and actually like kind of looser on their fingers. That's led to changes in the finger pockets that you can't see. If you just look at a glove, it'll look the same as a five finger, but Rawlings and other glove companies are modifying it within the glove. Yeah.
Inside,
so guys can have wider fingers, and they'll be empty fingers to create a larger pocket, essentially, but also more control as they wear the glove lower. Or I guess, is it lower on the hand or higher on the hand?
Well, it depends on depends on outfielder versus infield. Some of them part of their heel coming out.
They'll have it under their palm,
stopping it.
They
practice with the little wood squares. Just to stop it. My hand grabs it because I'm grabbing it and throwing it.
What
makes it, and what you said that about the back of these gloves now, like Francisco Lindor in his glove and working that issue, is the new gloves, these Rev 1 Rawlings, the backs are synthetic, whereas the palm and the front and all the fingers are still the leather, but it makes for a lighter glove. It doesn't, okay. The synthetic doesn't absorb water. And some of them actually, not to get into who they are, but have pictures of their kids on the glove.
Yeah. Well, that was something that they did special for Adam Wainwright, if you recall, with his last glove. His family and the glove manufacturer worked to put his kids' signatures in his glove, which was a really nice touch for that final season. And, you know, it made it all that more special. I mean, yeah, like, you know, Yadier Molina had his parents' names on his gloves stitched onto it, you know, not his own. And so you would see, you know, just you would see a mitt, a catcher's mitt with mom and pa on it, you know, in the script and in Spanish. And it was for, you know, the names that he called his parents. So that was, I mean, every glove has this personal touch. You know, how did you narrow it down to 50? You wanted to hit the high points, but did you get some personal choices as well?
Well, yeah, it was Mike Thompson and a couple of the others at Rawlings. We had a humongous whiteboard, and, you know, it's to take it to 50 greatest moments, a spotlight 50, you know, I tried to do it. As we said, we started in 1880s, you know, we got, you know, the very first gloves and who they were, and then up to today. So we wanted that cross current. You got to have people what they're familiar with, then what's interesting. We also had to kind of focus. We didn't want it to be all, you know, pitchers. There's a bunch of pitchers have a lot of gold gloves, you know, and you could make, you know, too many at one position. So we really wanted to balance it out, but we really wanted the moments, as we said, you know, who they were, what they were, you know, and, you know, we took models of the glove, because there's pretty much styles of, you know, you might have different names, and it's surprising how many, sometimes I look through the Rawlings catalogs and who is this guy? Because it's a name of a glove right in the catalog. So they, you have to look him up, because
you never.
But so it's like getting that cross cut of these are the different models, premier models through history. You know, you get the Mickey Mantle glove that came in, and then it was replaced by the big one was the trapeze. And before the Mickey Mantle, it was the Harvey Haddocks. Haddocks, you know, 12 inning perfect game that he pitched, got blown in at 13th with an error, but you know, in that the Mantle model is very close to the Harvey Haddocks, but Mantle was a bigger player, sells more gloves, and resonates with people. So picking them was, you know, generational glove model. What were the key moments of those decades? And you'll find them, you know. There's great stories. Like I said, the 1926 World Series, and then we get into some of the, you know, Christy Mathewson going before 26, 1905. World Series. Christy Mathewson threw three shutouts. Three World Series game, nobody touched the plate.
Wow.
And I think only about 12 guys touch a base, if memory serves me right. But we have his glove. There's the actual glove from Christy Mathewson, you know, pulled out of the Hall of Fame. And by the way, that was the first glove in their collection.
Really?
He was part of that. He and Ty Cobb and the others who were part of that first induction class. Mm-hmm. Ty Cobb also threw in his glove. But if you go back, you're up there working, and those are Christy. We have Christy Mathewson, Ty Cobb's gloves in there, but that was the first of their, I guess, thousands of gloves now.
Yeah,
you know, you think of a guy throwing three shutouts in one World Series. Great moment. There it is. There's his glove.
And he then went on to become a baseball writer. So
that's correct. You know,
really, yeah, upwardly mobile career. He went from three shutouts in the World Series to being a great baseball writer. Go figure.
Yeah.
That's the track that everybody takes, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, from Colorado to St. Louis, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's the same. I guess it's the same thing as now, like Hall of Famers going into broadcast, right?
That was
the media at the time. Ed, in addition to being an author and a historian, I think of you here in St. Louis and have such respect for what you've done as the keeper of the St. Louis Browns flame. And I know how much the history of the St. Louis Browns and keeping it going and keeping that fan club aware of the Browns' history here in St. Louis. I know how much that means to you. And it's from that perspective that I hope, you know, I can ask you this question and we can get a little romantic about baseball. When you think about the play that launched the Cardinals to their heights as the National League, you know, the winner of the most World Series and this strong tradition of winning and the how beloved they are in the city, that play that did it was a tag at second base of Babe Ruth, as you mentioned, by Rogers Hornsby with a Bill Doak model glove. When you look at the list of teams that have the most gold glove winners, it's the Cardinals atop with the first one to reach 100. And then right below it is the Orioles, who are the what the Browns became.
Yes.
You look at great third basemen. The Cardinals have had four tremendous defensive third basemen in their history, including the two most recent, Scott Rolen and Nolan Arenado, and of course Boyer and Kenny Reitz before that. You know, you want to talk about gold gloves at shortstop, one of the most demanding defensive positions, or you're going to talk about the Orioles and you're going to talk about the Cardinals. All right, here's my romantic question. What is up with St. Louis, given that the Orioles were born here, the Cardinals were born here, Rawlings was born here, the Bill Doak model was born here, and defense? What's up with St. Louis and defense in baseball?
Well, I'll just add one other thing that was born here, the Sporting News, which was for centuries the baseball Bible that everybody waited for that to come in the mail on Thursday's afternoon like I did. As soon as the mailman come, you rip it open. But, you know, I think it's a lot of it goes back to one character, and I call him a character, but a baseball genius, Branch Rickey, started with the Browns.
Okay.
And was there building the Browns after they came to St. Louis. They played the first year in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Brewers. People don't know that.
Yeah, that's right. I misspoke when American I said they were. League well, the farm. Orioles were born here. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and he had a style of baseball, and, you know, he wanted to develop players and get players with that Cardinal way we know today, focus on defense. I mean, you know, then you had, you know, certain coaches and things in the Cardinals organization. But then when Rickey got into a disagreement with the Browns owner is when he left and walked five blocks up to the Cardinal Stadium, because the Cardinals had yet to move into Sportsman's Park as tenants of the Browns. Sam Braden had just bought the team and told Rickey, make me a winner, make me do what it takes. And the Cardinals built that first minor league system. And I think that from that day on, they talked about focusing, you know, on how to play the game right. And so much of that, I believe, the impact coming from St. Louis, because once Rickey went to the Cardinals and Braden said, make me a winner, what do you have? 26, 28, 30, 31, 34, 42, 43, 44, 46. They didn't even give gold gloves away in those years, because that doesn't happen until 57 when it all starts continuing in the 60s and 80s and 90s and aughts here. So if you want to say there is a stream of what really put St. Louis there was, I think, Branch Rickey's focus on how to play the game. You know, that's why he built the minor leagues. I will develop players. I know how. I don't go out and have to buy players, because that was, you know, people forget. See, the minor leagues was pretty much free agents.
Yeah.
In those days. And he taught them, he created his minor leaguers and taught players how to play. And it all comes back. The Browns, Cardinals, who was the one man that was tied to both? Branch Rickey.
That's remarkable. Well, strong defense in baseball is definitely in the soil in St. Louis, whether it's the players that play here, the players who grew up here, the teams who have called this place home, or of course Rawlings, which is based here, not only provides all the official major league, the baseballs used in the game, at a few of them here on my desk, but also so many of the gloves, a preponderance
of gloves. More major leaguers use Rawlings gloves than all the other vendors combined.
Yeah, and there you go. I
mean, that's a statement in itself.
And they all have some tie to St. Louis, which I just find remarkable. All right, well, I began this conversation by asking you about your first glove. I'm going to close it with another question that's similar. All right, what of all these gloves, of all the gloves you researched, not just the 50 in the book, but of all the gloves you researched, Ed, which one would you like to grab and go out and have a catch with?
He did not play in the major leagues. He played in the first two College World Series for Yale. And I tell the story here, and it's George H.W. Bush. He was a World War II pilot hero. He loved baseball, came back. He was a good glove, pretty good hit, but not a great hitter. Politics was soon pushed in his direction. He would play in, as he went in Congress and became vice president, he'd play in a bunch of special pregame things or, you know, old-timers games, and actually had a couple good stories I put in there about him in the old-timers. But when he went to the presidency, he took that glove. It was a George McQuinn. George McQuinn, ironically, was a great first baseman with the St. Louis Browns. Did eventually go to the Yankees, but, you know, he was the big first baseman for the Browns in the 44 World Series. And he had this glove, and he kept it in the Oval Office desk all by itself. He would take it out, clean it, always making sure it was right. He'd be in meetings with all the advisors around the Oval Office desk, like you see on West Wing or, you know, Trump with his things now. And he would take it out when he was thinking, well, I got to do it this way because he was a left-hander, and pound the glove. And he'd even take some dignitaries who were in, let's go out on the yawn and have a catch. So I knew about that glove, and I think it had a special meeting. I do have a George McQuinn glove, but I don't have the one that George Bush has. It's in the library. I talked to his son, George W. Bush, to validate information and to get contacts at the HW library. And I think it's a really neat story. And I would just like one day, you know, hopefully we're going to have a book signing. I'll go down there and, you know, like you said, you don't put your hand in another player's glove, but maybe this time I might just like to. And it was an honor one day to come home, and George W. Bush had sent me a letter thanking me about putting his dad in the book, and in handwritten note saying, I am a baseball guy and I love this book. So, I mean,
that's great.
That, you know, it really, that is a glove, because it just has many ties to it. And there's a special story about George Bush and Babe Ruth weeks before he dies with George Bush. And that would be the one I'd want to put my hand in.
Thank you for sharing that story. That's author, historian, all around baseball expert, Ed Wheely, still playing the game in the senior circuit. So he has a glove of his own that other folks look at and go, man, I wish I had that glove. And you're probably making plays with it that have other members of your team going, man, I wish I would have made that play. You can find his book, The Finest in the Field, The History of Baseball Through 50 Iconic Gloves, anywhere you get books. It's available also at the Rawlings website. It's available at a lot of local independent bookstores here in St. Louis. Of course, it's available on Amazon. But seek it out there at Rawlings, or seek it out at any of the independent bookstores here in St. Louis. Or if you're not in St. Louis, then you know, still Rawlings and elsewhere. Great gift, great coffee table book, great thing to just page through, and great stories in it. Ed, thank you so much for joining me. This has been great.
Always great to be with you. You know, you do a great job on your podcast and your articles in the paper. You're a big part of St. Louis baseball yourself.
Thanks for saying that. You can find the podcast anywhere you get podcasts. You can find all of that Cardinals coverage at stltoday.com and in the pages of the Post-Dispatch. We are ever increasing the amount of content that we crank out about these somewhat surprising Cardinals. They're playing an entertaining brand. They're certainly bringing out the crowds. And you know what? No surprise that their performance is based on defense. I know that's a shocker.
Well, not a shocker to me. And I will say one thing, and I was going to say it, but I cut the for sure about Branch Rickey. I've gotten to know Chaim Bloom, and I've talked to him several times. I said, you're modeling Chaim Branch Rickey, and you can really see the parallels in how developing the players, keeping them down till they got their skills right, and defense. This team has got quite a defensive history here in just such a short season.
Yeah, I mean, the middle infield is pretty remarkable what they're doing. And, you know, I'm looking forward to it. We'll see where this goes. We'll certainly talk about it on the best podcast in baseball. It's brought to you by Closets by Design. And it's catching up. I'm catching up on it being weekly, Ed, as I got my voice back. So yeah. Thank you for being a part of this.
All right, buddy. Thank you so much for all you do.